Good afternoon. Really good to be back with you all again. And I'm more than delighted to be speaking for the first time, actually. I think we've done a podcast together with my dear friend and colleague, Eva Bartlett, who I've spent considerable time with in Syria and by accident at the entrance to the Rafah crossing in Gaza, which is where we first met. Eva is one of the rare journalists these days whose work is not only outstanding from an investigative point of view, but also a journalist who devotes her time to being on the ground in the places she reports on, as she says in her bio on Twitter and on her blog, which we'll mention at the end. Eva, welcome.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. Thank you for your very kind introduction. And I just want to say, of course, I reciprocate all those words back at you. You've done phenomenal work from a variety of places, most notably Syria, but also Gaza and elsewhere. And I mean, I know you're highly regarded for your incredible investigative journalism, being the foremost voice on the White Helmets in Syria. But not only the White Helmets, you've done a lot of really brave, morally brave and physically brave reporting from Syria. So yeah, I'm also honored to know you. But now we can stop slapping each other's back. And I just want to say the timing is really good that we're talking today and to talk to you.
What is it? The 22nd of the second, 2022?
It is 6 days after the Russia was supposed to invade Ukraine.
And it's actually the day which was predicted for all this to happen. And I've forgotten his name now, but I think I sent you the video from Ines's channel on Telegram. This day was actually predicted. I think he said at 4 a.m. So Putin was a little bit in advance of the predicted time. And of course, he hasn't actually invaded the eastern Donbas region. Eva, you're one of the rare journalists that's actually at considerable risk to yourself, spent time both in Donbas and in Crimea. I think initially what I'd like you to talk about are the claims. For example, I've seen a few today, even from independent media, that Putin is effectively carrying out a balkanization of the Ukraine. Talk to us about your experience in both Crimea and Donbas and how people really felt about, as it's described in the West, a Russian annexation or a Russian invasion.
Yeah, thanks. So I went to both Crimea and then the Donbass in 2019, August and September 2019. And I don't need to say this to you, but for the cynics out there, I did go at my own expense, of course, as I do to Syria and anywhere else I go to report, and as you do, Vanessa. In Crimea, I spent, I think it was 10 days. And okay, I don't speak Russian. I've picked up a little bit in the past year that I've been in Russia now, but still not enough to be conversational by any means. But I was with a friend, Vladimir, not that Vladimir, as I said in my travel video. No, a Russian American. He speaks fluent Russian, and he had been to Crimea, so it was very interesting to travel with him in 2019. I think he had been there in 2014. So what was really interesting was to hear his observations on how much things had changed for the better since he'd been there. So Vlad was both a friend to travel around with and also an interpreter. So via Vlad, for the first 5 days, I think it was, I was able to talk with locals in various parts of Crimea. And then he went back to Moscow, and I ended up traveling around for another 5 days, I think it was, just on my own. And I still was able to meet some really interesting people that shed light on the events of 2014, March 2014, when they held a referendum. And why they held that referendum, why they wanted to not just join Russia, but what I kept hearing from people in Crimea was that they wanted to return to Russia, which I think is a very poignant way of wording it, because Crimea has historically been a part of Russia. The Western media, I must say, this year, you and I, well, you're living in Syria, and I returned to Syria during the elections. And we saw in Douma, one of the most notable places in Syria, due to all the propaganda around, you know, a fake chemical attack, we saw the people out on the streets cheering for the fact that they were holding elections, right? And then we saw the aftermath of the elections when the main square in Damascus was just thriving with people celebrating. And my point in mentioning this is, of course, Western media and pundits and politicians dismissed the elections as, you know, not fair, just like they dismissed the elections in 2014 in Syria. And they likewise dismissed the referendum, not just dismissed it, but they vilified it, saying, of course, that it was a Russian invasion, right? And inferring, of course, that people were forced to vote and that it wasn't fair. But what I was told, the various people that I met there, they wanted to hold this referendum. There were no Russian troops on the ground, as was said apparently widely in the media. And I'm going to cite a little bit, if you don't mind, from an article I wrote after going
Sure.
there. Here, I'll just, well, so according to the official statistics, 90%, 96% of voters chose to join Russia. That's one point. Take that for what you will. And then when I mentioned Vlad, his observations, like even just at the airport, he said when he came there in 2014, it was a really outdated, old, and like just antiquated and not even functioning airport, and now it's a first-class airport. So that's one change. But most of the changes we were seeing, or he was seeing, were a huge development, improvement in the roads. We were seeing a lot of construction happening all over. And then we met a friend of his who went by the name Tata. She's Russian, but she moved to Crimea in 2012. And so here I'm going to quote from what she said. She said, I never saw so many people in my life go out to vote of their own free will. And then she made a point that before the referendum, for maybe 2 months, there were holidays. There was International Women's Day in March, and there was Defender of the Fatherland Day in February. And she said, normally during those holidays, people would go away. But that year, people in Crimea didn't go anywhere because they wanted to be sure they were home and could participate in the referendum if it came about. And they were anxiously awaiting it. And she said she herself went and see she went to see if she could possibly vote, but they said, no, you can't because you have a Russian passport. It was only for Crimean citizens. So she's making the point, you know, it was as fair as could be. And her husband was in America watching CNN around this time, and he was afraid for her because he was seeing reports of a Russian invasion. And she's like, no, there are no tanks in the streets, not at all. And she also talked about the change between 2012 and when I met her in 2019 about the roads being dilapidated. She said in the past 4 years, so that was in 2019, she said this, the government in Crimea had built 200 new kindergartens and of course the airport. And she said she worked in aviation and this airport in Simferopol was a very good standard and built in considerably quick time. But I think more importantly, more interestingly, well, I did meet some people when I was traveling alone. I flagged down someone just to ask for directions, and she ended up taking me with her husband in their car to an accommodation. And as we were talking, I asked her about it, and her English was quite good, so no language problems. And she said there were no troops, no military around us during the referendum. And she spoke of the joy of people there to participate in the vote. And she said, now we're under the wing of Russia. And she also mentioned improvements in the infrastructure and like the trolley buses and regular buses and schools opening. But I think what was even more interesting was later, again, I was on my own. And in Simferopol, I met a woman named Anastasia Grichina. And she's the chair of the Ukrainian Community of Crimea, Ukrainian Community of Crimea, I emphasize, formed in 2015. And their goals are to have friendly relations between the two peoples, Ukrainians and Russians. And she said she had also worked very hard in order they could have a referendum. So she's Ukrainian, right? And so, you know, the narrative being pushed down her throat is, Ukrainians are, I don't know, what, I actually don't even know the extent of the awful propaganda the West has pumped out, but presumably you would think they were, Ukrainians are being, you know, punished in Crimea, they're being tortured, I don't know what else. And she's like, we wanted to have a referendum. She was amongst a line of people trying to prevent, or standing with their bodies on the line to prevent the Ukrainians from doing any sort of attacks, preventing bloodshed, she said. She also mentioned one issue you'll hear put out by the Ken Roths of the West is the issue of the Tatars in Crimea. And there are some Tatars, a very small segment of the population, it seems, named the Mezhlis, that were trying to create provocations in order to cause problems during the referendum. But she said, you know, in Crimea, this notion that Tatars are being oppressed is also not true. She said there are three languages in Crimea, and it's Ukrainian, Russian, and Tatar, and those are official languages. And she also negated the lies about there being Russian soldiers forcing people to vote. Just skimming through my article, yeah, no military, etc. And by the way, the day that I met with her, she was in a hurry to go to a Ukrainian festival that was being held that day in Crimea. So, you know, that's just to put to rest some of that myth. And then the other interesting person I met there was a man named Yuri Gempel, a member of parliament, and he also chairs the Standard Commission on Inter-Ethnic Relations in the Parliament of Crimea. And he was pretty blunt. He's like, under Ukraine, Crimea was robbed. The ruling elite of Ukraine, of over 23 years, they robbed Crimea. They didn't build anything, and hence the crappy infrastructure everybody was telling me about. And he emphasized that, well, everybody I met, Vanessa, everybody I met were saying we're Russian, you know, our language is Russian. And as in Donbass, you know, the things they wanted were to be able to speak their language and have it taught in school, to retain their culture. And in Donbass, it gets, you know, even more like they want to be able to respect their history of having defeated Nazism, the Soviet army, you know, and that's something the neo-Nazis in Ukraine are actively demolishing, literally demolishing. You know, they were the precursor to all this woke stuff in the West, toppling statues. They've been doing that for years, and erecting statues and memorabilia in, you know, in favor of the neo-Nazis and Nazi supporters. So I'm just going to see if there's anything else he said. Well, people can read the article. I would encourage them to, because these people that I spoke to are very interesting. Ah, and he said in the 23 years Crimea was in Ukraine, well, in 44, there were people deported from Crimea, not just Tatars, but also Armenians, Germans, Greeks, Bulgarians, and others. And he said in April 2014, after Crimea rejoined Russia, President Putin immediately issued a decree regarding the deported people. And then a federal program was adopted with a budget of 10 billion rubles, including the building of multi-story buildings and improving the infrastructure for returned deportees to live in. He said Tatars make up 11% of the population and have representatives in all branches of power, including legislative and the parliament. And it's, as Anastasia had said, it's one of the three state languages. So it was quite interesting to speak with him. And the other thing I would just mention is, like, Crimea is absolutely stunning. It's quite beautiful. You know, it's a peninsula on the Black Sea. I happened to be there at the end of August, so the weather was really warm. Everybody was swimming. It was like, if you hadn't heard all the propaganda, it would never occur to you to think that there was any sort of invasion or anything negative happening there. People were just living their lives, and for the better, from all that I could hear from what people told me.
Did you get the impression that they felt protected by Russia, or that they still felt any threat from the Ukraine? And by the Ukraine, I'm talking about the NATO-backed neo-Nazi Ukraine.
No, they definitely felt protected. And, you know, I think, you know, when we get talking about the Donbass, obviously they've been being bombed by Ukraine for, what, 8 years now? Well, let me just skip down to, I was going to mention that, but since we're talking about this, I have it in my notes here. You know, some of the reasons people in the Donbass wanted, well, first, they didn't even want independence. Some of them told me they just didn't want what was happening in Odessa and in Kiev to come to them. So one man Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm skipping too much. Do you mind if I say this, or do you want me
No,
to just
no.
stick?
Go ahead. Just
Yeah.
whatever
So
comes to your mind.
one guy that I spent a lot of time with in Gorlovka, and then in areas 500 and 600 meters from the Ukrainian forces that are shelling these Donbas areas. His name is Dmitry Astrakhan. He was at the time a press officer. He's now returned to just being a journalist there, very courageous one, I might add. But he said, you know, when all it started, he was just like a normal apolitical person. But he said people were struggling for our rights. And as I said earlier, like the right to speak their language, have their education, memory of World War II. He was when I met with people that were defenders of the Donbass in the Zaytsevo area near Gorlovka, they said again, we chose to pick up arms and fight to defend ourselves because we saw what happened in Odessa. And yeah, and so you know, people, this concept that these are just crazy, well, they always say
Separatists.
breakaway, yeah, separatists,
Yeah.
exactly. These are people who just wanted to not be slaughtered or living under the rule of the fascist in Ukraine. I mean, if you're a journalist in Ukraine and you say something wrong, or you don't even do anything wrong, you go to prison. Look at Kirill Vyshinsky. You
Yeah,
know,
I
he was
was
an
gonna say.
editor. Yeah, he was an editor of a major, I think, RIA Novosti, of Ukrainian origin. He now also has Russian citizenship. And in 2014, he published, I think it was 14 or 15 articles of opposing views of what was happening in Ukraine, none of them written by himself. And then 4 years later, in 2018, the Ukrainians throw him in prison and accuse him of treason and all sorts of things. And he's done nothing wrong. He's an editor, and there's a disclaimer on all these articles, these op-eds, that these are, you know, the opinions of the writers. And they weren't one side. They were showing two sides, various perspectives. So if you can't even do that, like imagine the freedom of expression in Ukraine, and how terrified the other people that are thrown in prison, their crimes were like maybe being a taxi driver and driving somebody who was going to visit family in Donbass or something like that. You know, it's absolutely insane. So yeah, back to the question of people feeling protected. I would say most people would feel protected if they knew that Russia was going to be a presence there.
It actually, I mean, it reminds me when you're talking about Donbass, it reminds me of the situation in the Syrian Christian towns in northern Hamas, Gelbiya and Mahadeh, that I know you visited also after the one attack, which killed a number of civilians and the entire family of Shadi, if you
Yeah.
remember.
Amazing.
You know, and how, in fact, these kind of really organic national defense militia, national defense forces, grew out of the need to defend themselves against invading extremist groups dominated by Al-Qaeda that, had they been able to enter these towns, would have effectively massacred everyone in them. And not only massacred them, I mean, you and I both know the atrocities that were committed by these, you know, fanatics that are funded by the West. And it reminds me very much of what you're talking about in the Donbass region, that they basically have these neo-Nazis. And we know at the end of the Second World War that America effectively protected the Ukrainian Nazis and allowed them to take shelter in Europe before they then returned back to the Ukraine. So in reality, the people in Donbass were fighting against the Nazis in the Second World War. And there were also, I think it was Kevork Galmasyan that pointed out that there were actual fighters from Donetsk that had gone to Syria to fight against ISIS. So, you know, I think it's important for people to understand that the level of resistance that these people have had to endure, because it's not easy. You know, they've not really had support. And that's something else I wanted to ask you. You know, everyone always, the West always claims that the separatists are actually, either they are Russian military or they are receiving considerable support from Russian military. Was that something that you witnessed, or was it something you would categorically deny?
I can't speak to the support in terms of weapons or other. I don't know. I'll be honest about that. So, but as far as seeing Russian troops, they're absolutely not. I met one Russian man. He had been a Russian soldier. He had finished his service and he was volunteering in Donbass. And let me just find that. When I asked him why he was there, he basically just said, like, number one, because I have, principles and this what's happening is wrong, but also he didn't want what's happening there to come to Russia. So he was also, in a sense, defending his own country by volunteering in the Donbass. But other than that, I did not see Russian troops.
Exactly. And actually, I mean, historically until now, Putin has kept his distance from any kind of annexation or permission for Donetsk or
Yes.
Lugansk to be absorbed into Russia. He's maintained a very firm decision on that until, of course, in my view, he's been pushed to the brink by NATO, where he has effectively no option but to do what he did. And I think it was Marcus Godwin that made a point on social media that, in his view, Putin very probably had reliable intelligence, unlike the US intelligence, that Ukraine, obviously with the backing of NATO and predominantly US UK, were planning a major attack, which would have been a genocide in the Donbass. And therefore, he, and certainly it makes sense to me because I think you will also probably remember that in Ghouta, Russia was very keen to finish the liberation process. In Aleppo and in other areas, Russia has on occasions called ceasefires. It has halted the advancement of the Syrian Arab Army in order to negotiate with Turkey, et cetera, or the UN. And in Ghouta, the rumor was that Russia again had intelligence that America was planning to reinforce the terrorist groups in eastern Ghouta to push back against the Syrian Arab Army liberation. So it sort of makes sense to me. The reaction has been very similar for me in Ghouta and in Ukraine, as we saw last night. And from, watching Putin's address, there was definitely a sense of purpose, but also a sense of anger at the treatment of the people of Donbass. And I think he's always been, very, very empathic with them when he's speaking about them. And the sense that he had no option but to do what he did. Is that how you would read the situation?
Yeah, I mean, in his speech, he did mention Russia's concerns in general, the expansion of NATO, and NATO's weaponry in areas bordering Russia. But he went on to talk about how, for years since the Minsk agreements in I think it were 2014 and 2015, Russia has consistently encouraged there to be a political resolution and to for as he said, for Ukraine to keep its territorial integrity. But in the sense that the republics would have their autonomy, I think that's what they were pushing for under Minsk. But Ukraine has systematically violated Minsk. Sorry, I can't seem to pronounce that today. Accords by using prohibited heavy weaponry on a daily basis against the civilians of Donbass, and it's pretty ironic. And of course, it's no surprise that the astounding hypocrisy of the West. That whereas Russia and allies would emphasize, you have to adhere to the Minsk Accords and we have to find a political solution, the West just completely ignored them. They ignored Ukraine's serial bombing of the civilians of Donbass, killing of civilians. I think it's at least 10,000 people have been killed, and they've systematically ignored that. And now that Russia finally agreed to recognize the two republics, now we're hearing squeaks about the Minsk agreements, and it's just absolutely ridiculous.
But it's
But I
also
mean,
again parallels, sorry, it's parallels, isn't it, between the Syria narrative, in the sense that the Syrian Arab Army is always criminalized and demonized for defending itself and defending its people against blockades and sieges by the terrorist armed groups. In the same way, of course, the violations of the so-called ceasefire by the residents of Donbass in self-defense against a superior military force of the neo-Nazis in Ukraine, backed by NATO. But those self-defense operations are always amplified and vilified by the mainstream media, and there's very clear parallels there.
Absolutely. And I was going to say something popped into my head earlier when we're talking about the defenders of Syria and the defenders of the Donbass. Take a town like Maalula, right? Okay, yes, you did have the Syrian army and you had Hezbollah and you had other allies, but then as you and I know very well from talking to and being friends with people from Maalula, you had locals who had no military background whatsoever. And this is not, of course, exclusive to Maalula. You know better than I do about Skelbia and the men and women there. Who were not of military background necessarily, who have become the defensive forces over the years. And this is something I think people, when they're smearing the whether they're defenders in Syria or in the Donbass, they don't stop and think, like, what would you do in that situation? Same in Palestine. What would you do if your only option is to fight for your life or be F-16? Or if your only option is to fight for your life or have your head cut off, what would you do? And it's supremely I don't know. It's a lot of virtue signaling if, from people who disparage these defenders, but have themselves never even faced war. They have no concept of what it's like, So it just it, I know I think you share my same frankly anger and outrage. Crappy lives. They're not making money. They have very poor equipment, They're in horrible circumstances and they're exposed to great danger. And on top of that, they're being smeared and mocked and derided by people who either have no clue or who are very contemptuous and are doing it. I'm sorry about this. I'll just cut that off. I knew that was going to happen. Love you, Alex, my brother. Anyway, but and it's something else since I'm just talking about this. You and I were off before we started talking. We were chatting about, the actual people who are being targeted. And that's just something I remember you made a point years ago in one of your lectures, I believe it was. And I liked the way you phrased it. Like you talked about the disappearing of 3/4 of the Syrian population by corporate media or something like that. And it's the same thing. The media will talk about separatists in Donbass. They won't talk about, okay, as we've just said, who these people are and why they've taken up weapons. And when I was talking with them, I asked them, they're like, I used to be a truck driver. I used to work in the mines. I used to be whatever, And but they also don't talk about the civilians on these front lines being terrorized every single day and night. And
How many mainstream journalists were there in Donbass?
Oh, when I was there, I don't know. I mean, I didn't see any. I don't know. I think that the press office, I think my understanding, don't quote me on this, but I think probably in the early years, maybe out of naivety, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean like not being familiar with the way media, these media stooges and war propagandist prostitutes function. I think they were granted, some of these big awful corporations like BBC or whomever else, I think they were granted permission to report from the Donbass early on. But then after, I believe, this is my understanding, after seeing the nature of their grotesque war propaganda, I don't believe they're given visas. I could be wrong about that.
But I mean,
And
the
if that's
majority of the reporting on this conflict is from Kiev or from Ukraine, I
exactly.
presume.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, the areas I went to, north of Gorlovka, which is north of Donetsk, These are all like rural areas, and mostly elderly people there. Those who could leave have left, and the elderly have nowhere to go. In many cases, the people I talk to have no one to take care of them if they were to try to leave. So their only option is to stay there. Some just don't want to leave. You know, that's their life. That's they've lived there all their life, and their parents and their grandparents. So on principle, they don't want to leave. But you know, like everywhere you look, their houses are either destroyed or have gaping holes in the walls and the roofs, and people are still trying to live in these houses. And even like in one of the towns I was in, a house was smoldering. It had been completely burned out from being attacked 2 days prior, you know. And so this is the kind of scenes. Like one woman I interviewed, Irina Deacon, she was the head of administration of the town of Zaitsevo. She said it's been incessant shelling since 2014. And she said none of the ceasefire agreements reached there. And she said the town of 35,000 people is now about half. The school and the kindergarten have been destroyed. So the kids have to go to Gorlovka for school. Even the school bus has been attacked. What else was she saying? Oh, she also just said, like, yeah. And I heard this from many other people, like, in general, it was calm during the day, and then around 5 or 6 p.m., it started getting worse. Like the shelling and heavy machine gun firing started getting more intense. And one of the reasons I think Dmitry told me is because around that time, the OSCE doesn't report the observations, whatever that is. They don't report. I think I don't know what their many reasons are. One obvious one might be simply they can't see, it's dark. And so Ukraine capitalizes on that to do their worst to the brutalizing using prohibited heavy weapons on these civilians who have nowhere to flee. And just one thing I wanted to mention is I asked this woman, Irina, you know, what happens if somebody in your village, again, these villagers are 500 meters from the Ukrainian forces, what happens when one of them gets injured? Can an ambulance come there? And of course they can't, right? Because they'd be targeted. And this harkens back to my time in Gaza, where I did a lot of work with farmers and people living and working in the area where the fence encircling and caging Gaza is. And as you know, these civilians come under routine live ammunition fire by the Israeli army, maiming them and killing them for no reason. They're no security threat whatsoever to harass, kill, and drive them off the land. And I remember in that work I did with those farmers, when people get injured, it's the same thing. Ambulances cannot come there to pick up the injured because they will be targeted. So the important thing to note here for people who might not have thought about this is that if you're injured and your injury has, you know, an artery has been injured, you have a matter of minutes, I forget exactly how many minutes before you bleed out. And so this is the kind of scenario that's taking place in these areas near the front line that are being targeted heavily and increasingly so in recent weeks by these Ukrainian forces.
And I'm guessing the option to go from Donbas to Ukraine to see family, etc., it was almost impossible.
Well, that's an interesting question because there's another reason these elderly would need to go there, and that's to if they can try to collect their pension. And so I don't remember all the details, but I remember somebody told me it's a very arduous journey. Takes the whole day, and it makes some of them extremely wary to speak to the press because they're afraid of being penalized in any sense. I mean, they're already being penalized for living in one of the republics, right? Maybe I don't really understand how it works. Maybe I don't know if it's known when they go to collect their pensions where they live. It must be known, but in any case, it's just, you know, and their pensions are, I imagine, a pittance, so they're barely scraping by. But yeah, I don't really know the process of if they want to visit their family. I know somebody like me, I would be prohibited from entering Ukraine. Most journalists that report from the Donbass would be prohibited from entering Ukraine or added to their kill list, which I and
Yeah, I
Dino
was going to
Blanc.
ask you about that,
Well,
actually.
let me read from, I wrote an article about it a little while ago, and I'll just read a bit from that. The website, which has our photos and names and it, when they have it, passport and any other information,
It's a Ukrainian website, I presume.
yeah, it's a website which translates to peacemaker, ironically. It was created in 2014 after the Crimean referendum, and And then TASS wrote, it aims to identify and publish personal data of all who allegedly threaten the national security of Ukraine. Who? And yeah, so personal data, not only of journalists, but also artists, politicians, and other people who have visited, even just visiting Crimea, not necessarily even the Donbass. And then Dean just pointed out when I interviewed him about this, Dean O'Brien, a British photojournalist who's been to the Donbass. I think he was there in 2019, the same year I was there. Yeah, he pointed out, like, yeah, if they get a hold of your passport photo, they're publishing that. And then when I was writing this article, I just did some research. I found a report, Ukrainian war crimes and human rights violations. And it was talking about people who had been listed on this website and who had been assassinated after his personal details were published. There's one man named Oles Buzina. His home address was also posted on it. Oh, and the website, by the way, is Canadian based. I forgot about that. It's very fitting since Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, her grandfather was a Nazi collaborator, and she's quite proud of him, you know. So yeah, and it lists other people whose name and personal information were published on that website and then were assassinated. So it's not a trivial matter.
No, it's to be taken very seriously, and I think it demonstrates, I mean, as I said, the parallels between what is happening there and what has been happening in Syria are very stark and very clear. I think what is really interesting, I mean, the reaction when the Duma basically voted on the making Donetsk and Lugansk autonomous is the reaction from Latin America, from Yemen, even from Serbia, which is interesting because Vukic is basically pro-NATO, but even he said, you know, this will change the world order. And of course, the hysterical reaction from the UK, the US Biden this morning basically saying that you know, it's a threat to national security. I think someone should show him a map where Eastern Ukraine is and how on earth it's going to affect American national security is beyond me. But of course, expecting any logic or rational thought from the American administration is a long lost hope.
Well, I mean, I suppose it is near one of their over 800 military bases around the
Well,
world.
yeah, that's.
There's a thousand.
You know, and it prevents them completely occupying the majority of the borderlands to Russia, you know, through NATO. I guess Belarus is the other thorn in their side, and of course Belarus has
Yes.
been running military exercises with Russia leading up to this point last night. But I think another thing that I wanted to kind of just chat through with you and to, for the listeners, we haven't reached any conclusions on this, but I think it's worth bringing up because there are a large number of commentators that are mentioning the fact that, you know, this entire scenario is nothing but theater, that China and Russia are part of the WEF, that they are part of the transnational plutocracy power grab, that, you know, that this is can be reduced down to nothing more than maneuvers by allies, effectively. What they're effectively saying is that Russia and China are allied with the US, the EU, the UK, etc., in the COVID project, in the climate change project, and now in this project. My feeling, and we discussed it earlier today, is that I don't think it's possible to reduce this down to kind of one unified conglomerate of world leaders or world oligarchs that have exactly the same ideology, exactly the same agenda, and are working together towards an agenda that they all agree on, because I think that's virtually impossible, both culturally, ideologically, even from a power-based point of view. Russia and the UK, for example, are not natural allies. Neither are Russia and America. I wanted you to just express some of the things that you talked to me about regarding that, because I think it's, as I said, while we can't draw any conclusions, or I certainly can't, I think it's worth bringing it up and talking about it.
Yeah, I think my position in general with matters geopolitical is I don't like to speculate, I don't like to say this is what's happening. I don't know how the war on Syria is going to end. I don't know how this situation is going to end, and I feel like it's a waste of time to say definitively. It's okay to discuss things. I'm not saying don't discuss, but I think it for me it becomes a waste of time to sit there and say, okay, this is all this, and it's black and white like this. I think for me, I can't know all the details that are going on behind the scenes. I would agree with you that there are power struggles that we don't know about. I mean, on the one hand, this COVID 1984 great reset crap is overwhelming. It's terrifying in a sense. I know we're all fairly well informed, or more than myself, everybody's informed to a pretty good degree, right? Of the general plans of this horrible shift to a fourth industrial revolution, to a dystopian world that we don't want to live and be a part of. But at the same time, I think that we can be aware of those things, but not everything is about that. And like for me, what's important in this particular situation is these people have been living a hellish life of psychological torment and physical danger for around 8 years now. And now they have the prospect of having a force that can be a peacekeeper there and actually prevent Ukraine from raining hell on them and killing more people. I think this is, for me, the takeaway. This is the important point. Whether or not, I do see signs of, I mean, Russia is implementing a lot of the things that go along with this 1984 agenda, right? But at the same time, I'm inclined to agree with you. Like, it's not so black and white, and I don't see that this is necessarily hand in hand with this larger agenda. I think what you said earlier at the beginning, you were talking about Putin and his speech and how he essentially was forced to finally take this decision, particularly after the vote in the Duma, right? But also after Ukraine's increase in the increase in weaponry sent to Ukraine and British and U.S. forces there, the saber rattling, all this talk of war, and the increase in shelling on the people of the Donbass. I know it seems, for some people, it seems like, well, this is just theater, but for the people living under these bombs, this is finally a glimpse of light.
Yeah, and I think a really important point you made about Crimea is the investment from Russia. If we think about any country that the US has invaded and occupied, it's destroyed it. Whether it's Libya, whether it's Iraq, it's plundered its resources, it's destroyed infrastructure, it's polluted water sources, it's burned crops inside Syria. It's used depleted uranium, et cetera, et cetera. It's basically left a wasteland in its wake. And I think this is one big difference between, let's say, Russia and even China. If you speak to communities in Africa that are now working with China, they talk about, whether China is an imperialist power, whether Russia is an imperialist power, they further their imperialism in a very different way. It's not through tyranny and bullying and destruction and war and death and torture and abuse. It's through partnerships, it's through building and repairing infrastructure, as they are doing right now inside Syria. And I think that's an important point to make. However we view these global powers, as you said, for me, what's important is the relief that it gives to the people that have been living under oppression for so long, whether it's in Donbass, whether it's in Syria. Syria would not have survived without Russian intervention. And I think it's also important to make the point that many people have said, and I do believe it's true, that the US has tried to use Ukraine as a bargaining chip to get Russia to drop Syria, right? And what has Russia's response been to that? To increase its military hardware, to expand its military base inside Syria, to send its defense minister to speak with President Assad. Faisal Miqdad, the foreign minister, was in Moscow yesterday as all of this event was breaking, right? So Russia has sent a very clear message that no, we're not dropping Syria for Ukraine. We are going to manage both geopolitical situations. And I have to say that generally it's for the better of the people in those countries. So yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. What the future holds, we have to wait and see. But I think it's sort of a little bit precipitous to start saying, yeah, well, you know, this is just all part of the big game. Of course, there's also the Nord Stream aspect. Yeah, I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on that, nor really on matters Russia, but I am aware that the US has been trying to disrupt this. It's natural gas, right? Pipeline to Europe. That's one of the reasons they are. Well, I'm just trying to remember this article I read. Anyway, I'm having a brain moment. But it's certainly a bottom line doesn't have to do with caring about Ukrainian civilians' lives. It is in the end always about US's interest and wanting to prevent a European Russian alliance and you know, business dealings, trade dealings, etc.
Yeah, and it's also worth mentioning, of course, the very rich mineral resources, particularly in Donbass, and energy resources of coal above anything else, from what I was quickly reading through yesterday. So I think it's safe to say that the US's interest in Donbass is not remotely that of the people's safety and well-being, as it has never been in Syria or Iraq or Libya or Venezuela or Cuba or Yemen.
Oh, you know, well, speaking of Venezuela, and also we've talked about, you know, US hypocrisy. So it's very clear. I mean, it was clear to me after going to Donbass and speaking via translator with people who asserted that Russian is their language. They are ethnic Russians. And again, like, some of them were not political. Some of them didn't really need independence. They just didn't want what the neo-Nazis were offering up in Kiev and Odessa. But over the years, they definitely have proclaimed their Russian heritage, right? So it's very clear they don't want to be part of Ukraine, more so now that Ukraine has been bombing the hell out of them, right? Mm-hmm. So that's very clear. And it's very clear that Crimeans identify as Russians, right? Mm-hmm. And yet you have the West negating this. And at the same time, they promoted that Muppet Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela. Yeah. I mean, come on. And I know you've seen this, and I hope people listening saw the exchange. But if not, do look up the exchange between, I think he's AP reporter Matt Lee, and U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price, where this was a week or two ago, and yeah. Price was that Russia is going to invade Ukraine. Russia's going, and Ned's like, Matt Lee's like, come on, Ned, where's the evidence? And Ned's like, we have declassified evidence. And Matt Lee says, okay, well, give it to us. And Ned's like, I just did. And Matt said, no, what you did was you said Russia is going to invade. Please provide us the evidence. And then Ned actually has the stupidity and audacity to say, well, if you want, you can print out the transcript of today's briefing.
Yeah, that's, I know. Evidence,
you know, ridiculous.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Absolutely. I mean, you know, whether it is theater or not, I think generally what Syria and this situation have done is to expose the joke that is US and UK foreign policy, you know. And I mean, who is it? Truss, the British representative, who's issuing these statements which are just extraordinary. I mean, you know, she's banging on about defending the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of Ukraine, having effectively tried to destroy Syria for the last 11 years. And I mean, the hypocrisy is just off the scale now.
And you know, one other thing, they were all going on about the military exercises being held on Russian territory, not in Ukraine. And it's not like Russia is the only country that holds military exercises. I would note that every year the US, South Korea, and allies run military drills that simulate the demolition of North Korea. I mean, it's staggering hypocrisy, but these are self-defense exercises held on Russian territory.
Just one last question, and sort of more of a personal one. Would you like to be in Donetsk and Lugansk right
Yes, absolutely, I
now?
would. I did actually look into going there. So I moved to Russia a year ago, and shortly after, I did contact people at the press office to request, press accreditation, and I was given like the okay, like we could start the process. But then at the time, due to COVID measures, apparently only residents of the Donbass were being allowed to enter via Russia. So I have to find out what the current situation is. I would really like to go back there. I would like to go back, to areas that I visited. I know I told you this, Vanessa, but like one of the areas, it's called Mine 6-7. It was formerly a mining area. You were just speaking about mining. One of the first people I met was this really strong older woman who was in her 80s, I believe. And something about her really touched my heart. She just made me feel like she reminded me of my mom. Sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional now. She's living in a home that's it's not da it's not sorry it's not destroyed, but it is damaged. One of the walls looked like it was gonna crack, like it was cracked. It looked like it was gonna fall in at any time. Her husband had died some years prior. The front of her house was pocketed with I think ricocheted heavy machine gun fire. Her house was like Swiss cheese, almost like Swiss cheese, and she's living alone, doesn't have anyone to support her, and she's being terrorized every night by the shelling. And but she was very stoic, and she's just showing me around, talking matter-of-factly. I asked her, do you know who's doing this? And of course she does. I know that might sound like a stupid question, but I asked it because I don't like to put words in people's mouth, but I wanted confirmation that the people there know who's shelling them. Of course they know who's shelling them, just like I know you and I have talked about this despicable Lise Doucet, who works for the BBC, and her report in 2014 from Syria. She was there after a school had been an elementary school had been targeted by terrorists in Eastern Ghouta with a mortar fire, and had killed one child and injured 60 more. And she had been at the French hospital when I was there and seen these kids. And she went on to write a horrible article wherein she claimed that the Syrian locals actually believe it's the quote unquote regime that's shelling them, when they know damn well where it was coming from. They knew it was the terrorists in Eastern Ghouta. So it's that kind of dishonesty, that made me think, okay, I'm going to be very careful and ask the people I meet if they know who's targeting them. And they did know who's targeting them. But yes, I'd like to go back there. I'd like to see if she's still alive. I know that's a morbid thing to say, but I would like to see if I can reconnect with some of the people I met. But also, kind of similar to the vibe during and after the elections in Syria this last year. This year? What year are we? I know.
Last year, I
Last
think.
year, man. I lost track of time. I'd like to see, the celebrations we were seeing being shared on Telegram and social media. I'd like to go and talk with people and let them express how they feel about actually being recognized as independent.
I think that's one of why your work in particular is so important, because There are many analysts, let's say, but there are very few people that actually go and talk to the people that are enduring the situation that is being analyzed by various journalists, academics, think tanks, etc., predominantly in the West, but some, of course, in Gulf state media, as we know, particularly regarding Syria. And I think what is so important about this work, and again, it's under threat from, of course, the COVID project, which is making travel very difficult for independent journalists. And it's something that I've been raising the alarm about because, of course, the mainstream journalists can travel anywhere, right? Independent journalists are far more restricted anyway. And then add to that the COVID restrictions and the fact that the majority of good independent journalists are not buying into the whole vaccination passport program and so on and so forth. So it's a clear attempt, in my view, to prevent voices like yours, mine, a number of other very good people that are trying to be on the ground during these crises, during these conflicts and these occupations, blockades, etc. It's being made very difficult to do so. So, I personally, for me, this conversation's been really interesting because I don't think we've ever really sat down and talked about your time there, although I've read your work. I hope it's been a real eye-opener for people as to what it's actually like on the ground for these people. Where can they read more about it?
So my article on both on Crimea and then a separate article on the Donbass were both published at Mint Press, but they are also on my blog, in Gaza.wordpress.com, and on YouTube. I also have a backup of all my videos on Odyssey, but on YouTube, I created a Donbass playlist. And I did subtitle the video interviews I did with people, so people could watch those if they want to, see the kind of destruction I was talking about, and see the citizens I was meeting. And I just wanted to say one thing also about journalism, kind of the nature of the reporting we do versus corporate media, because I don't know how many people have actually sat down and thought how media functions. I'm sure your listeners are actually very well-informed people, and maybe this is going to be like old news to them, but I hadn't actually thought about it until I met our colleague Patrick Corbett a couple of years ago or more in Western Canada. Now, he used to be a producer for some Canadian media corporation, and he was the one that said it to me. He's like, when you and Vanessa, you go to Syria, you're doing, or anywhere, you're doing all the logistics on your own. Everything from, finding the cheapest plane ticket, which usually in my case involved like multiple layovers and sleeping on benches, to getting the visa yourself, to doing all the stuff you do on the ground, arranging the meetings, doing the interviews, doing the translations, subtitling the videos, writing the articles. If you look at a given New York Times article, like particularly if it has to do with, international issues, you'll find sometimes 3 to 5 people listed on that article, and it's just staggering. And I know, Vanessa, you do your own subtitling. I know that, I speak colloquial Arabic, but I don't feel it's adequate enough to represent the people I'm interviewing. So I know you have somebody or people that you can send your interviews to get accurate translations, so you best represent the people you've interviewed. And I do the same. And in contrast, these corporate media prostitutes go in teams, have everything paid for, and we don't. And I'm not complaining, I'm just making a point here. They have all the resources and all the abilities to produce
Absolutely.
flashing reports, right? And all the research and translation help that they could ever need. And they still produce shit. And they still produce lies. Obviously, they produce lies because that's what their intent is. So I just think, when we're talking about independent media, this is not to toot anybody's horns. That's not my intent here. It's more to say it's pretty astonishing that independent journalists that go places like this, wherever, and there are a number, like I mentioned, Dean O'Brien, and I would encourage people to follow him. He really keeps a sharp eye on events in Donbass, but there are many people like yourself, myself, Dean, and other people who put their own money and life on the line to do this because, you know, we believe in getting the truth out there, right? As opposed to this horrendous war propaganda machine. And you know, Stephen Kinzer is another one. So anyway, I'm kind of rambling, but I just wanted to make that point since you were talking a little bit earlier about like kind of the nature of media and how hard it's become for independent journalists to report.
Exactly. And you know, again, I just want to say thank you for going to the places that you go to. And contrary to the popular opinion, you know, we do, even though we are often in Syria together, we work very separately. I know most people kind of assume we're joined at
Well, look,
the
when I was there in 2020, I entered and then I ended up staying for 6 months. How many times did I see you during those 6 months? I would say less than
not
four,
very many,
probably.
actually.
And we weren't having a tiff or anything. It's just like we do it.
No, I know exactly, but it's just
Wait,
kind
okay,
of.
but I have to say, the funniest mix-up of you and me was when Sean Penn said he met you in LA. Here in California.
Yeah, no, on a BBC on a BBC disinformation series.
I was like, Sean, you met me. Vanessa's considerably taller, blonder, and more British than I am. Like, I know a lot of vodka that night, but come on.
That was kind of a classic because physically we don't look remotely like each other, but regularly on Facebook, for example, someone will respond to my post and call me Eva and start having a whole conversation with you about my post. And I'm like, hold on, I'm having an identity crisis here.
You know, now that I just sit and think about it, I think aside from going to Duma together during the elections, and that was with a media delegation, I maybe I'm forgetting something, but I think
We
the
went to
only
Aleppo together, if you
that's what I was going to
remember
say,
that.
the only thing we've done together was in August 2016 when Aleppo was being pounded by terrorist mortars and missiles. We went to Aleppo via the northern Castella Road, which is also being pounded by mortars, at our own expense. It was like $200 each way, right, in the taxi. That's the only time I can remember that we've ever done anything in Syria together, other than meet up in Damascus once in a while.
Anyway, so we've put that myth to bed.
Well, that said, let's start a podcast together.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've really enjoyed talking to you on it. I mean, I don't know why we do it, but we tend to kind of avoid each other. I think because I don't know, maybe kind of kicking back against the idea that we work as a totally, you know, as I said, joined at the hip team, or just I don't know,
I
we
think it
kind of take
also.
each other for granted in that way. You know, we know each other's work so well.
Yeah. Well, I think also, like, we both started looking into the white helmets after Cori Morningstar. Hats off to her always. But then you were the one that just went after those fraudsters with such a drive and determination. You're the reason, honestly, that they are known to be the terrorist accomplices or terrorists themselves, actually, staging fake attacks. You're one of the prime reasons, and so a lot of your work, not all of your work, and because I don't think that you should be pigeonholed as only as the expert on the white helmets, but a lot of your work for a while was on that. So I think that's another reason why our paths didn't overlap so much, because I saw, you're doing this amazing work and research. So then I started doing other things, like, I don't know, going to Madaya or going to other places that
Yeah,
were being
exactly.
popularized about. Because there's just so many layers of propaganda when it comes to Syria and, of course, any other major issue. And so I think, like, yeah, it's important that we support one another, but also, like, we don't need to replicate one another, right?
Yeah, exactly. But no, I'm glad you've got my back and vice versa. And yeah, we should do this more often.
All right. Well, I am planning, after I move house, I'm planning on becoming a little bit more systematic and producing a podcast fairly regularly. And I would be honored if you and I can come up with like a decision, whether it's once a month or more frequently to do a joint podcast.
I look forward to it. We'll have to think of a suitable name for it. Sorry, that was a dog squeak in the background. They're kind of waking up.
if my brother doesn't mind, we could borrow from his landscaping company name, B Squared.
Yep, I like that idea. Definitely. Eva, thank you. Eva, not Ava. Also, I called Eva.
Oh my
Ava
God, that's the first time since 2012 when I met you at the Gaza border that you've ever said my name is Eva.
Yeah, just so people realize, for years I called Eva Ava until she told me about, I don't know how many years we'd known each other. She's told me, the way, my name's Eva, not Ava.
And you continue to call me Ava, but that's okay.
Yeah, I prefer it.
I got into this mentality when I'm in Canada, it's Eva. Everybody knows me as Eva. When I get to Syria, it's Ava because that's how they pronounce it there.
Yeah,
here, exactly. In Russia, it's Eva, which I really like, Eva. So I'm like a nomad with my name as well.
Yeah, exactly. All right, hon. Look, thank you so much for your input today. And I hope people do go and have a look at the videos and catch up on the articles that you wrote, both on Crimea and Donbass, because they're very important. It's very important at this stage, you know, with everything that's going on, that we remain human and remain in connection and in contact with the humans of this world that on one level or another are resisting all forms of tyranny, surveillance, violence, brutality, abuse. So thank you, Eva, for always, Eva, for always keeping that human aspect at the forefront. Thank you.
Thanks, Vanessa.